Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network for this Tuesday, the 24th of September. This hour, the multi-layered story of the attack on the Nairobi, Kenya shopping mall. We'll learn more about Al-Shabaab, the Americans from Somalia who lived in Minnesota, and according to Kenya's foreign minister, were among the killers. The efforts by Al-Shabaab to recruit Americans to come to Somalia, the political situation both in Somalia and Kenya, including the CIA counterterrorism training program for Somali intelligence agents. To bring you up to date on what's going on, there are conflicting reports this hour as to whether or not the Kenya mall siege is completely over. The country's president said within the last hour that the four-day siege is now over. He addressed the nation, announcing 3 days of mourning. The AP has reported that three of the mall floors have collapsed, with more bodies trapped inside. NBC is reporting that gunfire can still be heard. The death toll now includes 61 civilians, 6 slain police officers, 5 dead attackers. President Kenyatta says he expects the figures to rise. There are 11 gunmen in custody, 5 have been killed. And as the terrorists evidently came from various countries, so some of the confirmed victims were from all over the world. From Australia, an architect who worked in Africa creating eco-lodges and socially sustainable tourism in ecologically sensitive locations. From Canada, a Border Services liaison officer in Canada's High Commission to Kenya. From Ghana, a poet and professor who was a former ambassador to Brazil, Cuba, and the United Nations. From Kenya, a popular radio and TV personality. And from the Netherlands, a senior vaccines researcher for the Clinton Health Access Initiative. Our guest this hour is Professor Abdi Samatar, who teaches in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Society at the University of Minnesota. He is Somali-born. His research focuses on the relationship between democracy and development in the Third World in general, Africa in particular. He studies Islam, social capital, and ethnicity in the Horn of Africa, and environment and development. For you to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Samatar, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
This is such a horrendous story, isn't it? And it's a story that takes in the whole world in terms of victims of terrorism, in terms of political problems within countries, in terms of recruiting terrorists, and the randomness of horrendous violence. It's very disturbing.
It's quite a gripping, gruesome atrocity that Al-Shabaab has engaged in. And it's just mind-boggling for any person of any faith that some people can imagine pretending to use their faith to slaughter innocent people anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exceptionally gruesome.
How is
in large measure, Catherine, because I actually was in that mall in June when I was in Nairobi and had dinner in that place.
Oh, my.
So I got shivers when I heard this was the place they have done their dirty work.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
How were 15 people, we think there are 15 people, able to conduct such an act of terror? Where did they get what kinds of weapons?
Well, you see, Kathleen, and many of African countries' borders are relatively quite porous. It's not like ours. Even the most guarded borders, which are the United States, people can still get through it, and these are more so than anywhere else. So Kenya's borders are significantly porous, and they sort of could come from all kinds of directions, from the sea, from the land, from Somalia, from Ethiopia, from Sudan, and so on and so forth. So it's really very hard to contain those borders in such a airtight manner to prevent people like this coming into the country.
And tell me about how this organization formed. I've read it was sometime between, 2003 and 2005. Who are they and why did they form?
Catherine, it's a very long story, but to make it short for our audience, and there's something which was called the Union of the Islamic Courts, which operated in Mogadishu, quite a diffuse group of religious clergymen who ran local courts, because remember, Somalia hasn't had a government since 1991. The rule of law was basically part of the historical despin, and there were no police, there was no military, there was no public services, there were few hospitals, there were no public schools. And so these religious men and their communities began to organize Islamic-based courts to sort of punish criminals who were stealing and killing and things of that sort. And they were community courts. But at that point in time, the country and the city was dominated by the brutality of another set of terrorists called warlords,
mm-hmm.
who turned the city into sort of a isolated units where they raped, looted, and killed anyone they saw decided. And so these people were so horrified by this, and the community was so sick of this running and being sort of subjected to this for 16 years, they began to informally mobilize themselves to get rid of these people. And they were able to succeed that come 2006 springtime.
Mm-hmm.
And a small fragment of this court militias were called Al-Shabaab. In Arabic, it means youth.
And were they identified in some way with Al-Qaeda, supported by Al-Qaeda or not?
Not at all at that point in time. And some of them, one or two of them, may have been trained in Afghanistan in the old days when we were fighting the Soviet Union in that part of the world. And so so what happened then in 2006, the city of Mogadishu, which has been tormented for 16 years, was at peace when the warlords were chased out of town. People could walk around. Women can work day and night, if you like. And there was a sea of relief, finally, that the hell was over. These individual small groups were there at that point in time. They were not listed as part of a terrorist group by our government. That happened in 2008, 2 years later. And so this, in a sense, is the beginning of what we know Al-Shabaab today. But what then later happened was that our government and our allies in the region thought these courts, who have pacified Mogadishu without the assistance of external international forces at no cost to anybody, may be terroristic in nature. And then Ethiopia decided on Christmas Day of 2006 to invade Somalia, occupy Mogadishu, chase these people out of town, and begin to bombard the city with helicopter gunships. That is the beginning of this war that we are dealing with today.
Mm.
And then consequently, a million people were sort of fled Mogadishu because of the Ethiopian bombardment and became refugees in their own country.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, Somalis decided to reorganize themselves to fight the Ethiopian occupation. And the toughest groups among those in the Union of the Islamic Courts were Al-Shabaab. It's really the Ethiopian occupation, supported by the Western world, in my opinion, that ultimately turned a fragment of the Islamic courts into what we know today as the terrorist group Al-Shabaab.
Hmm. The United States bears some responsibility?
Quite, in my opinion.
How so?
Well, for instance, we have the evidence now that the Ethiopian government, as it wanted to attack Mogadishu and Somalia, basically gave the green light to the Ethiopians. And then we provided them with resources. In fact, we provided them with $90 million immediately, which they went to buy guns and weapons and things like that from North Korea, of all places. So our taxpayer money indirectly went to North Korea at that point in time. And then secondly, the British government and the American government provided them with intelligence and satellites. The former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the State Department in Washington is on the record that they at least to minimally admit that we provided that kind of intelligence to the Ethiopians.
What were we worried about? Was this after 2001? We were worried about Al-Qaeda presence that wasn't there, but we thought it was?
I think that's what was partly. But also another former Assistant Secretary of State, Herman Cohn, said that the Ethiopian intelligence was feeding false information to the U.S. government, which may have influenced our policy. Our concern, of course, legitimate after 9/11, was to protect our shores and our interests all across the world. That's quite legitimate. But I think that became the business of terrorism, become such an ideology that we lost our intelligence in terms of calculations as to what's the appropriate tactic to use where and when, and how to protect civilians in any engagements that we have overseas. So it's that ideological worry which I think unfortunately propelled the United States to give the green light to Ethiopia to preempt what we may have thought, or our leaders thought, was the potential of a terrorist group coming out of Mogadishu.
So our intelligence was off.
Was terrible, to say the least.
So now we find the result of some of that. Obviously, there are other considerations, but we need to understand better what's happening on the ground in some of these countries. You probably are familiar with the work. We've had him on several times, Jeremy Scahill, who talked about this really large CIA operation, secret CIA operation that was, and maybe still is, I don't know, operating in Mogadishu.
It still is. I've read Jeremy's reports, but I knew much of this stuff long before Jeremy wrote about it. I go there usually at least three times a year.
Mm.
The last time I was there was this past June, end of June. And that operation is still there. My thinking is this. I mean, I think there is a legitimate war to keep terrorists out of our shores and to hold them in places that they cannot do any damage to anybody, certainly Americans. That's completely legitimate. And any government or any people worthy of their name will do so. Where I think we missed the boat, in my assessment, is to overreach that project and to ally ourselves with hideous people, regimes such as that in Ethiopia that has itself brutalized its own people.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they have documented that left and right. And then to sort of alienate others who are trying to liberate themselves from warlords who have terrorized their families for a decade and a half, and to alienate those people. So then they say, why should I worry about America? They are not worried about my own life and my own concerns when I have done nothing wrong here. So I think our intelligence is so driven by the ideology of the war on terror,
mm-hmm,
that we have missed the boat and did certain things that in the long run doesn't serve the American interest, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And I missed the part of the story, Professor Samatar, when you said, I think you said the warlords were driven out. They were driven out? They don't exist anymore?
No, they don't exist anymore. That's one of the successes of the Union of Islamic Courts in 2006.
I see.
Today, the Western world, particularly the United States government and the European Union, are spending hundreds of millions a year on something called the African Union Force for Somalia, AMISOM, to sort of keep the peace, if you like, but also to sort of hold in Al-Shabaab in their right places, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
We have yet to spend a fraction of that in Somali security forces, because my assumption is, and my belief is, and my thinking is, if we were to spend, you know, maybe last year we spent $500 million on sort of on that force. If we were to spend $100 million every year on training legitimate professional Somali security force, I'm absolutely certain that Al-Shabaab will be history, except in fragments and remnants all over the place. So the Union of the Islamic Courts, without any assistance, cleaned Mogadishu up of the warlords. People were back able to breathe life again after 15 years of tyranny. And unfortunately, if we were to engage with those people seriously, and there may have been elements in them that were quite unsavory, I think if we engaged positively with them in such a way that it was a positive sum game, the Somalis win, the Americans win, everybody won, I think we will be looking at a different picture today, in my opinion.
Hmm. All right, taking the story of Al-Shabaab now and the actions of the last few days in the mall in Kenya, how do you take their discontent with what's going on in Somalia to Kenya and this horrendous attack in a shopping mall where you're killing people from all over the world? What's the aim of that?
Well, Shabaab has absolutely no legitimate reason to attack innocent civilians in a shopping mall, children, women, adults, whatnot. So there is absolutely no excuse in that regard. I think what they are trying to use, and I hope the politicians in Nairobi and in Washington don't fall for this sort of, if you like, trap, is to use Somali grievance, legitimate Somali grievance against the government of Kenya and pretend that they are speaking for Somalia. So what are the legitimate Somali grievances against Kenya? Kenya invaded Somalia in two years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now controls one of the richest southern provinces of the country around the port city of Kismayo in the Indian Ocean. And the original claim was that Al-Shabaab, who had controlled that city, was running forays into Kenya, destabilizing the sort of a tourist-based economy. And they actually hijacked a few people from Kenya and took them to Somalia. So it was a preventive action. And so many Somalis were quite sympathetic that the Al-Shabaab should be chased out of this. Kenyans moved their troops, and in the process, hundreds of Somalis were killed, innocent Somalis were killed. Nobody had sort of a cried for them or mourned for these folks. Kenya has occupied that city now for almost a year. And what they have been doing is to, rather than sort of tell to the Somali government in Mogadishu that they can come in and begin to build sort of a local administrative infrastructure, they have told the Somali government that they cannot come in here. And the rest of the Somali people begin to see that Kenya's agenda was not only Al-Shabaab, but maybe, in fact, it's trying to re-engineer and redraw the maritime boundary between Somalia and Kenya, because it has been said that there may be some resources in there. And so those are legitimate Somali people's grievances against Kenya. Al-Shabaab is trying to get a legitimacy out of that in doing its illegitimate deeds.
There are so many levels to this. And then the leadership in Kenya, I mean, they sound like a bunch of thugs. It's from a cursory examination of this, but the current leader is under investigation and prosecution by the International Criminal Court, right?
That's correct. I mean, he and the president and the vice president of Kenya are, in fact, the vice president was in The Hague, and they had sort of stopped the proceeding so that he can go back and deal with this issue. But both of them have been accused of, and they have not been, that those accusations have not been yet proven in court, so we cannot say they are criminals yet. But they have been accused of masterminding the plot-letting political exercise in the elections of 2007. So there is a question mark in there and then on these two individuals. But my hope is that, regardless where that court case in The Hague ends, that President Kenyatta will be wise enough that he will not react to this in a knee-jerk reaction and therefore begin to say, you know, Somalis are terrorists and therefore we need to deal with them. Because some of the people who have been injured by Al-Shabaab in Kenya is a friend of mine who is a Kenyan member of parliament, who is a Somali himself, a Somali-Kenyan. And I hope wisdom will prevail and said, you know, what we need to do, Shabaab's majority is in Somalia. The international community has been funding this AMISOM force rather than the Somali security forces. I think now we can say that Shabaab is in sort of a danger to all of us, and therefore we need to support the legitimate demands of the Somali people in their country to rebuild their state and their government and institutions so that they can take care of them in that country. I think if that is done in Washington and that's done in sort of in Nairobi and that's done in Brussels, that may be the most powerful sort of a victory that we can get out of the jaws of Al-Shabaab.
One more question, because there's a Minnesota connection too, which is fascinating. Before we go to phone calls, the foreign minister is saying that there were at least two of the gunmen were from the Minneapolis area. A couple questions here. One is, have you heard confirmed reports of that? And we've heard a little bit about recruitment of Somalis in Minneapolis. How did the Somali population get to Minneapolis, and has there been extensive recruiting, and why would they be recruiting abroad?
First of all, I heard the Kenyan sort of foreign minister, who herself is of Somali ethnicity, and say that what you just told me. I checked the last time I checked in the sort of State Department reports in Washington said they have no confirmation of this. They have no evidence to substantiate or not substantiate that. The British Foreign Office said the same thing. So I think we need to pause and take the evidence very carefully. But I will not be surprised, because this has happened before, that a number of young Somali men, not all Somali youth, not the majority of them, the very few of them have been able to join Al-Shabaab. And the first, I think, American suicide bomber was a sort of a person from this community from Minneapolis. So I will not be shocked at that. So let's keep our eyes open. Let's keep our sort of cool until we see the evidence. And then let's not criminalize communities in totality, but look after those individuals who may have helped the recruitment process and so on and so forth. The next question you ask it is, how did the Somali community came here? Somalia is an orphan of the Cold War. The Soviet Union then and the United States were at loggerheads in that part of the world. And unfortunately, the leadership in that country were not wise enough to avoid that kind of a trap. they fell into that trap. The country was destroyed, basically. And then a couple of million people fled into different parts of the world. 40,000-50,000 of them are here in Minnesota. Why did they come to Minnesota? I think for a number of reasons. Minnesota, Wisconsin, these are the sort of most progressive states in the country. And Minnesota is said to be the sort of social democratic state in the United States. So when you are a refugee, you are looking for shelter, you are looking for good schools, you are looking for employment. And Minnesota always had a lower employment rate. I think we have now less than 5% when the country is about 7+ something%. So there were easy jobs for even the unemployed. The schools were decent. The cost of living was okay. The social services provided by the state was excellent by U.S. standards. So they sort of flocked to this place. I came to the University of Minnesota in 1992-93. There were two families, including mine. The other family was a family of a man who's a sort of electrical engineer. Mm-hmm. Now there are about 50,000 of them in the state, I'm told.
And why would you not be shocked if we found that one of the killers had been recruited from Minnesota?
Because this won't be the first time. It will shock me if it was the first time. But since our government suggests and has evidence that a number of young men were recruited by Al-Shabaab, both before Al-Shabaab became a terrorist organization in our books and afterwards, and that, in fact, one of them has committed a suicide in parts of northern Somalia, then I would not be shocked, because that has happened before. And so Al-Shabaab must have been using the same kind of avenues to possibly get at these young men.
I see. We go to phone calls. We'll welcome them. Our guest this hour is Professor Abdi Samatar. He is Somali-born. He is an expert on East African politics, a professor of geography at the University of Minnesota. And we're talking about the many levels, and there are probably more. We've outlined quite a few. The history, the politics behind this, what Al-Shabaab is, the politics of Kenya and of Somalia, the multi-layered story of the attack on the Nairobi, Kenya shopping mall. The president of the country is saying it's now over. There are some reports saying it's not completely over. And if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can send us a tweet. We are on Twitter at KDunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Abdi Samatar, and let's start with Morad from Minneapolis. Hello, Morad.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, perfect. I've just got a statement and one question for the professor. He mentioned the fact that Somalia was a lawless country for 16 years. Why is it that in the early 2000s, when it became a country of law, a law that its neighbors did not approve, like Kenya and Ethiopia. Here's the actual question, the statement, then the question. So when they formed some type of law in Somalia, it just happened to be a religious law of Islam, and its neighbors, Ethiopia is a predominantly Christian nation, as well as Kenya. Its neighbors didn't approve of this type of religious law. I'm not sure what Somalians as a whole, as a country and its people, believe. But they had some sort of peace when they had Al-Shabaab running their country. So the question then becomes for the professor, why is it that within the 16 years of no law, why didn't Kenya or Ethiopia get involved then, but decide to get involved after Al-Shabaab formed some type of law within Somalia? So they chose to invade or get involved in Somalia when they had a form of law.
Okay.
Their neighbors, Ethiopia and Kenya, do not approve of, so they invade the actual country. That I don't understand. I just don't understand that. The professor mentioned that the country was lawless for 16 years.
All right, Professor Samatar.
Yes, thank you for the question. First of all, I think Ethiopia is not predominantly Christian, according to the statistics. It's both Islamic and Christian, but the regime is Christian. Kenya is predominantly Christian animus, but there is a significant Islamic population there as well. To come back directly to the question, Al-Shabaab did not run the Union of the Islamic Courts as I said, they were a very small fraction of that, of a very broad coalition. And so the Ethiopian government and the Kenyan government have a security agreement, which they signed in 1963. The largest region, ethnic region in Ethiopia is predominantly Somali. There is a significant region in the northeast of Kenya that is sort of Somali also. And both of them have been worried about Somalis in those regions. And so they went into this security agreement and a protocol in 1963. And I remember sitting in Nairobi, finding out in 2002 that there was an agreement, there was a meeting between the Kenyan and the Ethiopian security forces, or intelligence, I must say, which said, you know, Somalia is weak now. This is our chance to put it away forever, basically. The invasions will come after that, of course. But it, particularly Ethiopia has been involved in the previous 16 years that I talked about in one form or another. But I share your sentiments as to why would you want to create more instability in Somalia when the people are trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together in a peaceful way without involvement of outsiders. That the Ethiopian government has to answer, that the United States government, which supported that intervention, has to answer, I think.
And thanks for the call. Shelley in Platteville, hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering if the professor would like to comment on any relationship that al-Shabaab may have for what was formerly known as CARE, Council for American Islamic Relations, but they have since changed the name to the Washington Trust Foundation. If there's any relationship there that you would like to comment on.
No, there is no relationship whatsoever.
Thanks, Shelley, for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. There, of course, we tend to look at situations like this and worry about the United States and the safety of the United States. Some analysts have said, because of the apparent sophistication of this attack, that it could be an indication that al-Shabaab has been forming stronger alliances with al-Qaeda in Yemen or other places, and that there are ability to attack other countries may be greater than it used to be. What do you say?
My sense is that I missed part of the question because the line was not very clear. So can you repeat, Kathleen, the question?
The people worried about this attack being so sophisticated that it may indicate that this group has more alliances with al-Qaeda in Yemen and other places and might be able to conduct attacks in other countries.
Certainly, I mean, al-Shabaab has bragged about its association with al-Qaeda, so that will not be surprising, whether it's the sort of a Yemeni branch or the one in Afghanistan or in Pakistan or wherever else. But I think what has happened, the horrible things that have happened in Nairobi, say something about the soft targets they are aiming at. They are not taking on military installations or security installations, but soft targets, civilian enterprises, such as a shopping mall. I've been to that shopping mall, as I said, Catherine, and they'll check you and search you, but I think it's easy to quite slip through that in any civilian system. And so I wouldn't say this is sophisticated. Yeah, the guns they have are not terribly sophisticated guns, and then they have grenades and so on and so forth. But I think it's the nature of the target that they have that makes them look as if it's sophisticated rather than what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that they will try to do something like this again somewhere else unless they are stopped dead on their tracks, in my opinion. And I have suggested how we can do that in a way that's sustainable, that's respectful of other people's lives, and that can bring all of our communities, Kenyan, Somalis, and everybody else together on this front.
Is anybody calling for that?
Well, I have certainly been writing about this and calling for this for many years now.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me real politics is not really about what's good for ordinary people, but mm-hmm. what's good for sort of those who are in positions of power, wherever those might be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for that matter, it doesn't take sort of a rocket scientist to say the European Union and the United States are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this security system. Which works some of the time in some places, but that if you have a professional national force that's disciplined, that's paid enough, they will take care of this themselves. and it will cost so much less, both in terms of money and human losses. Why aren't we doing something that's so obvious? I can only, my only explanation, it's the nature of politics.
Professor Samatar, there will obviously, because of the victims of this, were all over the world. Some had government positions. Many were doing very good work in Kenya and in other parts of the, of Africa. What happens behind the scenes here? Do leaders of these countries get together and figure out how to proceed in terms of making sure their countries are safe, or making sure that al-Shabaab is taken care of? I'm just wondering what everybody's doing today.
I think I can fully appreciate and understand the anger which most Kenyans and certainly President Kenyatta feels. I mean, in his own backyard, his people have been slaughtered, and others who were visitors, well-wishers for Kenya. And so I can understand the anger that comes with that, but also the responsibility of a leader is not to be driven by anger, but by wisdom, because ultimately it's wisdom that prevails over hate. And it's a sort of a care about ordinary people, both yours and others, that will override any kind of this kind of a sort of a craziness in with al-Shabaab. So my sense is that President Kenyatta will convene, and it will not be business as usual for the presidents and prime ministers of the region, and that they will take up this issue, one of providing, telling the European Union and the American government that 50% of the resource going to AMISOM should immediately be shifted to establishing a professional national security force for Somalia that's accountable to its own people. Mm-hmm. Second, that Kenya, which President Kenyatta has control over, will begin to sort of cede the territory of Somalia they have been controlling for 2 years to the Somali government and under the umbrella of the African Union force. That will mollify whatever pretexts that al-Shabaab has, and Kenya will not be hurt by that. In fact, I think that will bring the Somali people and the Kenyans together in one bond.
Hmm. And who, has anybody been calling for Kenya to cede that territory?
Well, I mean, for instance, there's some regional organization called IGAD, I-G-A-D, and two months ago, if I'm not mistaken, and Kenya is a member of this, an important member of this, called to Kenya to allow the Somali government to take over the airport and the seaport and begin to do so. Kenya did not openly resist that when the call was made and when the agreement was signed. And then once their delegation went back to Nairobi, Kenya, they said, they are not part of that. So Kenya has been playing a game in this business in Somalia that is not genuine, in my opinion. And I hope the new president, who has been only in power for a few months in Kenya, will be wise enough to say, this is not our business. We want to support our African brothers in Somalia. And let's sort of turn this territory to the African Union force, which has been working very closely with the Somali government.
Mm-hmm. How is, I read somewhere that Kenya called on the assistance of Israel to investigate al-Shabaab or to investigate what happened at the mall. What do you know about that?
Well, what I know is the few things I have heard over the lines, over the wire services, is that I think there were some Israeli sort of forces who were assisting the Kenyan military and police to sort of overcome the resistance in the mall. That's really all I know. How successful they have been, how deeply they were involved, I don't know. But also there's a longer historical relationship between Kenya and Israel. For instance, a couple of years ago, I think, when al-Shabaab became an issue for Kenya, the former prime minister of Kenya, Mr. Odinga, Raila Odinga, went to Israel to request this. And so that relationship has developed since and was there long before that. But I don't know the details of how deep they are involved.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you've been at this mall, in terms of the number of people who were killed, they were from all over the world, from Britain, France, Ghana, Canada, China, India. There were Americans who were injured. This seems to be an incredibly international place. Why is that?
Well, it's the place where the elites of Kenya hang out. And so ordinary Kenyans who earn $3, $4, $5 a day, cannot go and buy things in that place. So it's really the top echelons. It's the most, quote-unquote, prestigious mall in the country, in the heart of the city of Nairobi. And then so tourists oftentimes and diplomats are sort of attracted to those kind of places, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And this time it was quite unfortunate that they were there.
Mm-hmm. So these were tourists mostly?
Some of them were tourists, some of them were diplomats, some of them were sort of people who are resident in the country. So it was a mixed bag of people.
And who are the elite in Kenya? We also have this perception, I've never been there, but we have this perception that Kenya is a prospering country in Africa. We tend to look to it as a place that's doing quite well.
In certain ways, and certain segments of the population are doing quite well. In others, they are struggling. I mean, one of the largest slums in Africa is in Nairobi itself. And so there are people who are barely making a living and then people who are indulgent in opulence, if you like.
Right. We have the same thing here, don't we?
Even more so there than here, because, you know, the Kenyan parliament, for instance, I am told gets members of parliament are better paid than our congressmen.
Hmm.
And this is a country that's, you know, quite poor. Compared to the wealthiest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
An email comes in from Ursa who says, I am a Somali here in Wisconsin and we condemn the attack. Al-Shabaab are terrorizing Somali people and East Africa. Please let us know if you know, Professor, how they are financed.
I don't know how they are financed. And, our government really doesn't know how they are financed. There were claims that, you know, they get their money through the so-called hawalas or money transfers, but our government over a decade or more has been investigating this, has not turned up any evidence that Hawala are involved in this. But there are sort of different kinds of people. Al-Qaeda may subsidize them in certain ways, I don't know. They may be able to raise money through all kinds of avenue, but nobody has yet brought the evidence to say, this is the main source, because if we knew that, then we can block those, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. Our guest is Professor Abdi Samatar, expert on East African politics, professor of geography at the University of Minnesota. And we are talking, the president of the country is now saying that the Kenya mall siege is over. It's been going on for some time, and there are some conflicting reports as to whether or not that is the case. He expects the figures of those who have died to rise. There are 11 gunmen in custody, 5 have been killed, 61 civilians, 6 police officers have been killed, and there are hundreds of people who have been injured. So we're looking at the complexity of this story. Two more of your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Professor, thank you for trying to help us understand the complexities, both political, social, economic, and historical, as we're also learning from the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea, the Middle East, so forth. Do you have any analysis on what the influence and the consequences of the so-called American neoconservatives, when they had so much influence on President George Bush after 9/11, has that figured into the complicity and the mistakes and the damage that the United States, such as we've had in Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Middle East also?
Thank you for the question. That's a very good question as well. I think the neocons, if you like, in our country damaged our country and damaged others in many ways. In 2006, when we had the opportunity to help Somalis turn Somalia around, the neocon ideology of the war on terror blinded them to the possibilities and the opportunities that existed in that country. And unfortunately, the current president and his regime have stayed the course on that front, certainly. And so the neocons, I think, have done a great deal of damage in terms of our perceptions in alienating others who may actually be our allies in this war. So I share your sentiments, but there's plenty of evidence that the policy and the ideology of the war on terror that has been pursued has not benefited the United States and the people of the Horn of Africa in any significant way.
So why do you think it hasn't changed?
Well, I think that the president of the United States, who was elected on a progressive agenda, at least so it seemed at the time, need to be asked that question. And I think what you see in politicians, when they get together, they are the ones who know each other. They don't know what the issues and the problems behind each leader is. They believe in one another to a significant degree. And so when the president meets with certain African leaders, you know, they are tap dancing and talking as buddies, if you like. And the ordinary people's issues are not ventilated in those places. So they really mask the reality that prevails in many of those countries.
Thank you, Kurt, for your call. Richard in Madison, hello.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Not too bad. I'm sorry, I kind of tuned in late, but I just wanted to mention a couple of things. One of the things you asked about was the relationship with the Israelis, and from what I had gathered, part of that mall is actually owned by Israelis.
That's correct.
Number one. And number two, the relationship goes way back. And not too long ago, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, there was an attempt to shoot down an airline flying out of Mombasa. And I think it was an Israeli airline. I can't remember, but it's certainly
No, you are right. It was an Israeli.
Part of that connection goes back, and Kenya's relationship with Israel goes, you know, pre-independence day. There have been relationships. And the other thing is, when you talked about it being such an international community, part of that is a consequence of Kenya having been one of the more stable countries in the region for many, many years. You've had a lot of international, whether it's journalists, organizations and stuff like that, based there. And consequently, that's why you have that mix of people there. So that kind of helps explain, you know, why there is such a mix. And having, I actually grew up there, and, you know, it was very common for us to, in school, certainly mingling and being in school with lots of kids from many different countries. And so that's, you know, way back even in the 70s. So anyway, an interesting show. I'll have to listen to the earlier parts on the internet, but thanks again for the show.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, I would just like to add to what Mitch said. All the things he has said is quite right. The most stable country in East Africa is actually Tanzania, rather than Kenya. There was an attempted coup in the 1980s, I think. And criminality in Nairobi is much more significant than any other major city in that region. But it's the most important economy in the region.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Richard, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Inside Kenya and certainly in Somalia, I'm just wondering, I haven't really had a chance to delve into news reports from those countries, but what is the best way for the Kenyan government to respond to this once it is indeed over? And what are you hearing about response in Somalia?
I think, and I will have to leave you a few minutes from now, Kathleen, unfortunately, because I'm teaching.
Okay.
And I think what the Kenyan government can do is first attend to the injured and the people who have been incredibly traumatized by this. That should be our first priority while securing the borders in any way we can. And then the second thing is, I think, for the president, in my opinion, President Kenyatta, to convene, set up a national commission, much like we did here, but a national commission not so much as to investigate, but to mobilize the Kenyan citizenry to begin to hold their hands together as one people and to look after each other's, sort of be our brother and sister's keepers, so as to unite them not on the basis of faith, not on the basis of ethnicity or anything, but as Kenyan citizens. But that also would require the kind of economic justice that doesn't prevail in Kenya to be transformed so that more people are getting better off than they have been, particularly from the margins of that society.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think for President Kenyatta to re-examine their involvement, their military occupation of southern Somalia, and to begin to approach the Somali president on an equal partnership as to how to untangle this issue.
Mm-hmm.
For the Somalis, in my opinion, and I think they have seen the horrors of Al-Shabaab better than anybody else anywhere. What happened in Nairobi is a piece of cake compared to what Somalis have gone under Al-Shabaab. And so they have a great deal of commonality with ordinary Kenyans. And my sense is that the Somali president will have to stand tall now and speak to his people in the most powerful ways possible to bring them together so that they can rebuild their country on their own terms and not on the terms of other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have to go now?
I will have to go in a minute.
Oh, so you can take one call.
Yeah.
All right. Mohammed in Cedarburg. Hi.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. Thank you, Professor. You did something fantastic here.
Thank you.
I'm just going to take a general geopolitical view of the world since I was born. I was born in 1945. This war of civilizations between Muslim countries and with the West, which eventually led up to the us and them and the crusades of the Bush administration and so on and so forth. I think these are all little small fires which Americans have been putting out of all these post-Second World War. And unless and until the basic problem between the Muslim world and the other non-Muslim world, that is the Israeli-Palestinian question, is not resolved, and it festers, and it becomes a chronic issue, we will never end this war. Imagine, how can 1.6 billion or 2 billion people be at war with another 3 billion people? These are all just a little fire. We had the French in the Mali. Now we had Pakistan, and nobody endorses the Christian church. People are sick of it.
Professor.
I couldn't share your sentiments more. I think you are absolutely right. It's a farce to talk about Islam versus Christianity. I grew up in communities in East Africa where both faces existed, certainly in Ethiopia, where there was no conflict between the two peoples of faith. I think when you begin to politicize either faith, religion that is, or ethnicity or race or other things of that kind, other identities, then you don't look at the humanity of individuals and communities. You look at them as the other, and that's the problem. And President Obama, in the next 3 years, has an opportunity to make a difference not only in the United States but in the world in standing up for those principles in places like Kenya, in places like Somalia, in places like Afghanistan. I think if he loses that opportunity, it would have been a waste for many of us who voted for him originally and who are now incredibly disappointed with his policies overseas.
Professor Somata, thank you very, very much for being with us. You've been a wealth of information. Thanks.
Well, pleasure, Kathleen.
Professor Abdi Samatar, and we thank him for being with us this hour. He is Somali-born. He's been teaching for some time here in the United States. He is in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Society at the University of Minnesota, research focusing on democracy and development in the Third World in general and in Africa in particular. He is no longer with us, but I think our next caller can say what he has to say, which will be interesting, and then we're almost at the end of the hour. So let's go to Oliver in Lancaster. Hello, Oliver.
Hello. I've been able to be in Kenya on three different trips about 10 years ago.
Mm.
And I was wondering, in regard to the relationship between the African and the East Indian population within Kenya, and it seems it's not just the black and the white, but also the black and the brown. And the conflicts that they have in those three situations, does that have any bearing in regard to the whole Somalia thing?
Mm. And I'm sorry.
That was kind of my question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Our guest is gone. But I'm interested in the East Indian population that made its way to Kenya. How did that happen?
They were the first, as I understand it, I did quite a bit of reading. They were the first, slave trade, and dealing with the tribes within Kenya and East Africa. Of course, they were a part of the British Empire. So it goes back to, that whole area. The British Empire had pretty much control of Kenya. That was their their colony together with, and then others were by other German and other European countries.
Thank you, Oliver, very much. Oh, there are a lot of levels to this story, aren't there? It's complicated and tragic. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour, and we have another hour to come, so we're going to boost your brains.